The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk.
Tehran erupted into flames as Israel and the US last night launched a fresh wave of devastating strikes. And you can see the glow of destruction over the skies of Tehran in any of the news reporting. They turned a disquieting red filled with acrid smoke after several oil and fuel depots were blown up across the Iranian capital, and the Middle East conflict rages on. Now, to talk about all of this, Paul Rogers, Emeritus Professor of Peace Studies at Bradford University. Paul, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, let's talk about the latest. I mean, the Americans and the Israelis combined are inflicting huge damage on Iran. So the question is, have they lost the ability to defend themselves? Have they lost the ability to be offensive in terms of targeting elsewhere? And have they lost the ability to raise any money because they can't sell any oil?
It's difficult to say entirely, but I think if you look at it from the perspective of the American and particularly the Israeli strategic thinking, what we're seeing is the development of sort of plan B in the entire operation. Plan A, which was basically the assassination of the leadership, the Ayatollah, and as many of the senior people as they could, in anticipation that essentially Iran would be so damaged in leadership terms that it would come to heel, that it would have sketched some sort of peace deal at a very early stage. That was very much what the Americans expected. I think the Israelis were prepared to give that a try, but I'm not too sure they ever thought it would really work. And so we're now on to Plan B, which is a variant of what is known as the Tahir Doctrine. And that's a standard Israeli war doctrine, which basically says, if you can't win a war by direct means, and this is usually applied to insurgencies, then you inflict as much damage as you can on the societies that are actually supporting the war, the other side, your opponent. And that, I think, is what we're now seeing. And it's very clear in terms of what the likes of Pete Hegseth and some of the American commentators are saying, and it's pretty clear from what the Israelis are doing. They're going all out to do as much damage as they can. Torture might broadly call the Iranian infrastructure. And in doing so, they believe they can sort of bring the country to heel. They're certainly going to be extremely damaging, and there are going to be many people killed, but they see this as the main way forward so far.
Now, it's one thing to do that in Gaza and even their activities in the West Bank. These are in confined areas. Iran is an enormous country. And to try and destroy every bit of infrastructure, to try and, I suppose, demotivate ordinary Iranians, it might be difficult over that kind of scale.
It might well be. And I think what they're trying to do at the moment is to concentrate primarily on Tehran as the capital city. 10 or 11 million people compared with 2 million people in Gaza, of course, already is huge. But there doesn't seem to be any other way for them to do it, as far as one can tell. The United States in particular is absolutely against any sort of use of truth on the ground. And I think the Israelis as well would prefer not. But in one sense, I think one has to see that Israel in particular is now in a trap of its own making. What I mean by that is that Israel will have to win this war because so much damage is being done to Iran and Iranian society that if it doesn't win and something is left behind, if any sort of usable Iranian system is left behind, one thing I think could be more or less guaranteed, and that is any entity, any group, any government that is in power in the future, and I'm talking about months and maybe years, will be looking to develop crude nuclear capabilities as soon as it possibly can. There's no other way forward from its point of view in terms of seeing its a state becoming secure. So in other words, Israel has no alternative but to go on until it gets such a decision on the Iranian side, such an admission of defeat, that it will really do what it's told, and you will even have ground troops or inspectors to go in and make absolutely sure there's no work going on the nuclear side.
But isn't that the lesson for other countries, wherever they might be, in the Middle East or elsewhere? Let's get a nuclear device, because that's the only thing that'll keep Trump and his ilk out.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. And this is what is really worrying the nuclear arms control people, people who specialize in trying to see nuclear weapons brought under control. And you look at what some of the things that are coming out of the American Arms Control Association, which is a very effective think tank on these issues. And they're saying, you know, we're heading into really very bad news and an increased climate of nuclear proliferation. The fact that you've had a combination of two nuclear powers trying to take on and destroy a major 93 million strong population non-nuclear power indicates that essentially that power really needs to have nuclear weapons. Now, that's disastrous for everybody. And I think it's only just being realized what the consequences of that are in the long term. But I think you're absolutely right, and this is the way we're going to go unless some other way can be found forward. And as far as Israel is concerned, you have to go this way. There's no alternative to getting full defeat of Iran now they've started it at this level.
Now, what do you make of the interview that Trump gave to Dana Bash last evening on CNN, where he said he wouldn't rule out having a cleric at the top of the Iranian leadership? Now, we know a supreme leader has been chosen. We don't have the name as yet. I'm sure we'll get that imminently. But does that indicate that Trump is trying to follow the Venezuela Delcy Rodriguez model, keep the regime in place more or less, find someone who's amenable to either cooperating willingly with the Americans or can be bribed to do so or persuaded to do so? Is that his game plan? It would not be the Israelis, I presume.
It certainly wouldn't be the Israelis, no. And I think this is the major issue that we're going to face if we get to that point. It's very difficult to really discern what Trump is really up to. He changes so much, and we're not even sure that he is representative of the way that power is being used in Washington. We tend to focus very much on the president, any president, but in fact, I think it's people more behind the scenes who are being more cautious on this and in some ways trying to move him away from the rhetoric on which he is so pleased. It's interesting to see what one or two of the really senior American military are saying or even letting slip in their tone. And it's clear that they are not happy with the way this is going. You may have the likes of Hegseth saying, no, it's going very well. You know, we're the tops. Trump making these nonsense calls about, you know, we don't need help from the British. They're coming in when we've already won the war. The United States has not won the war, not remotely. But it's, in a sense, I think there's this sort of almost a delusion that the war is going well. That is not, I reckon, what the American military see as a senior level. One thing to add, though, one mustn't forget that within the quite senior American military, and that also includes to politicians like Hegseth, you have this very strong evangelical Christian nationalism pervading thinking. And yeah. I don't think people are realizing there's even an element of what you might call a holy war in the minds of some people, I stress only some people, but they're people of influence quite high up in the American political system.
Now, one of the things the IRA used to say about the British security forces was, you've got to be lucky all the time. We only have to be lucky once to do what Gerry Adams described as a spectacular. The targeting of a desalination plant in Bahrain, for example, I mean, that's interesting because if those kind of plants are taken out and they would take ages to rebuild, it could make those areas unlivable in.
And that's true. And of course, that is something which I think people are forgetting. There are these vulnerabilities, and clearly there's a big sort of reconsideration of thinking about where those vulnerabilities lie. As far as one can see, but it's pretty hazy and not necessarily well coordinated, one thread of opinion within the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps is frankly straightforward economic warfare. And that is to find ways of putting the price of oil and gas up so much that essentially, basically the West, particularly in the person of the United States, becomes almost in a position where it has to act in some way and recognize some sort of peace. Probes have to be put out. And I think we may well see that. People tend to forget the huge impact of the oil price rises back in 1973-74 in the aftermath of the Yom Kippur Ramadan war. Now, that was of a different order, but oil was very cheap then, but it went up by 400% in the space of 7 months. Even if it doubles now, then that is going to play havoc with the world economy. And certainly behind the scenes, I think there are a lot of worried economists and others, because there is this capability. It may be rather shorter term. The rises may not in any way match the 73-74 level. But don't forget that that led to some extent, to very widespread stagflation, the combination of stagnation and inflation. In fact, it led on very much to the transition through to a more strongly neoliberal economy for much of the world. So here again, this apparent war in one part of the world may well be sort of have global repercussions. And I think this is now starting to be realized. I don't think the Israelis are too worried about this. The United States, of course, now is more or less self-sufficient in oil and gas, whereas it wasn't then. Now, with all the fracking and the rest, it's actually in a stronger position. And I think it'll be the countries in Europe and probably China as well that will be more worried about this.
And, of course, that would push up the price of goods everywhere. Now, I should ask you, what was Tony Blair at? He made some remarks at an event sponsored by the Jewish News, where he criticized Starmer for not backing America straight away instead of coming in with limited help, an offer of help rather late in the day, echoing, I suppose, Trump's thing. Is this Tony Blair trying to say, I was really right all the time about the Iraq war? I was right going in when the world, and particularly the Labour Party, thinks he was wrong?
Well, the Labour Party certainly thinks that pretty widely now, and there were massive public demonstrations in Britain, and many people thought that, you know, it had had some impact. But I think what is coming out, I think, of the Tony Blair Institute for World Order, or whatever it's called, is that essentially Iraq is different. The Iraq war at that time was different to what we have now. So I think it's putting a little bit of distance between the current situation and what he said before, rather than saying this is an extension of that. But certainly, I mean, basically, Blair is very much on the right, I think, on many of these issues, and is determined to that stay to make that the situation. And of course, he has become extremely wealthy in the process and pretty influential among some regimes.
I mean, why would he want to join that parcel of rogues they call the Board of Peace?
Well, I think essentially he has a particular view of his destiny, and I think it is it's a rather unusual view in terms of a sort of a former Labour Party Prime Minister. But this is what we face, and I think, you know, most people see it, and he is not very popular in Britain now as a result of this. And in fact, I think Starmer is really in a very difficult place politically. But I would think that what Starr has been saying, trying to put a bit of distance between him and Trump, actually goes down quite well in Britain. But he has so many other problems, it won't make a difference overall.
But I mean, Blair, he didn't stab him in the back, he stabbed him in the front.
Yes, he did. And that's extraordinary. But essentially, it won't have a huge impact because of the status that Blair has in Britain now. Obviously, on the right, I mean, the Reform Party, the Conservative Party insofar as very much left of the 50th time, that will welcome it. But I think among the broader body politic, he is not hugely significant. One other thing which I think we do need to recognize is that essentially you do see Starmer now allowing the United States to use two key bases, the big RAF base, or US Air Force base at Fairford in Gloucestershire, and also the big base Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean. But I think one has to recognize is it's going to be very difficult to really make sure that all the ordnance is going through those bases and the planes that are taking off are only involved in what you might call this curious concept of offensive defense or defensive offense. We're not sure which. I mean, you know, we've seen 4 or 5 of these very large strategic B-1B bombers flying into Fairford just yesterday. It's on the television screens as the rest. Well, if they're going to be involved in large-scale bombing, and if they bring the B-52s in, they're particularly suitable to area or to carpet bombing or area impact explosives, then essentially it's very difficult to see Starmer not being tarred with a brush of being going for a sort of full-scale destruction of infrastructure in Iran. And that is what is happening. It's basically a war over infrastructure. And the number of hospitals that are being hit, for example, is reminiscent of Gaza, but on a hugely greater scale.
Paul Rogers, Emeritus Professor of Peace Studies at Bradford University. Paul, thank you very much for joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show, Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. on News Talk. conversation that counts.